up to stand up. Stand up.
Stand up. Stand up. Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. Welcome to the March 23rd edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's kick off with African football. Teams across the continent are getting ready for the final two rounds of qualifying matches for the 2022 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Cameroon. The matches will be played over the next week, and then we'll know all 24 teams that officially booked their tickets to Cameroon. So far, five teams have qualified. They are host Cameroon, which earned an automatic berth, defending Nations Cup champion Algeria, Mali, Senegal, and Tunisia. In a Group B qualifier on Wednesday, the Cranes of Uganda will host the Stallions of Burkina Faso in a top-of-the-table encounter. Burkina Faso leads the group with 8 points from four qualifiers, while Uganda has 7 points. Magume Davis Rakawinge visited the Ugandan Cranes at their training base, and he joins us now with a feature preview from Kampala, Uganda. Sporty greetings, Magume!
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Uganda Cranes players train under the guidance of the interim national team head coach Abdallah Mubilu at St. Mary's Stadium Chitende, venue for the encounter with Burkina Faso Stallions this Wednesday. Head coach Jonathan McKinstry is currently suspended by the Federation for Football Associations in Uganda, FUFA. Midfielder Michael Azila says players and great spirits ahead of the game.
This game is really important because, you know, this will set everything up. We'll set the team up, you know, usually if you're going to go away. But right now we're trying to focus on this game. You know, if we win this game, for sure we'll be into this tournament. And like as you say, like, it's really, really important for us, but also it's important for the country. So winning this game is everything for us. So we need to be focused and be focused on winning on this game. Do we have the ability to beat Burkina Faso? Yeah, we play different teams and we play different kinds of players, but besides that, like, I know we have talent, we have a very talented team, and you know, we have the likes of Dennis Onyango, Kui, and first of all, you know, we just need to be focused and be prepared and really organized, you know, but at the end of the day, we need to score goals, which is really, really important. But I know we're capable of winning this game.
Azila plays for New Mexico United in the USL Championship, America's second soccer division. Moses Waiswa, another player, agrees. Unlike Azila, Waiswa, who plays for SuperSport United in the South African Premier League, missed their encounter when Uganda played to a scoreless draw when the two teams met in Ouagadougou in November 2019.
The feeling is superb because I really missed playing home and playing for the colours. So it's really a good feeling to be back, and I feel the excitement to play the game against Burkina Faso. Because you don't know what's going to happen in Malawi, so it's better to win our home game. Yeah, and we hope for the best in Malawi.
Uganda Cranes is second in Group B, having amassed 7 points, while Burkina Faso leads with just 1 point ahead at 8 points. The Cranes will be boosted with the return of striker Patrick Kadu, who scored the winner against Cape Verde as Uganda seed the slot at the past AFCON finals and went on to score the opener as Uganda beat fancied neighbors DR Congo 2-0 at the 2019 AFCON tournament. Kadu says we score again, given a chance to play.
It's what I want. Every player wants that. Yeah, it's what I want.
Coach Abdallah Mubilu says it won't be an easy game, but insists his team will get maximum points.
We played against them. They were very competitive. They really challenged us. But we have the potential, and we are only looking for that spirit we've always had when playing home. A win at home will motivate us to go and get a point we need from Malawi away. So this win is very crucial. It is the one that is pushing us into the other game. Very crucial, and we are going to work so hard to make sure that we get it.
Sports analyst Elvis Senono agrees. He says Mobilu, having worked with most of the Cranes players as a coach at club level and as an assistant coach to McKinstry, has all it takes to take Uganda to the AFCON finals.
They know these players. They've seen them for much of their adult life. So there are some basics that they start with that you think will be important for the Cranes. There is also the positive of the Cranes having picked a goalless draw away in Burkina Faso earlier in the campaign. So while many people might be afraid of the names that might be associated with the Burkina Faso team, we're going to mention the Bertrand Traore here, who plays in Aston Villa, the Kabores and all. But having got a result, a goalless draw away in Burkina Faso, that gives you confidence that you can pick the result at home, never mind that there won't be spectators.
The other Group B members, South Sudan, lying bottom of the group at 3 points, will host third-placed Malawi at El Lal Stadium, Omdurman, Sudan, with each team needing to win for a chance to remain in contention to play at Africa's biggest showpiece. The top two teams in the group qualify for the AFCON finals. The Cranes will wind up their qualifier against Malawi Flames just 4 days later at Bingu National Stadium, Lilongwe. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Thanks, Magume. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, has disqualified Chad from the Nations Cup qualifying competition. The decision comes after Chad's Football Federation was suspended by the country's Ministry of Youth and Sports. CAF has rules in place which punish political involvement in national football federations. Chad had no chance of qualifying for the Nations Cup in Cameroon. The team had only 1 point and was at the bottom of Group A. As a result of the CAF decision, 3-0 victories have been awarded to Chad's final two opponents in the qualifying competition, Namibia and Mali. Now, Mali, as I mentioned earlier, has already qualified for the Nations Cup and now leads the group with 13 points from 5 matches. Guinea is second with 8 points from 4 qualifiers. Guinea will host Mali on Wednesday, and Guinea will qualify for the Nations Cup with a victory.
Hello, listeners. My name is Juma Miro, the Commonwealth Games bronze medalist in Australia 2018. Listen to Southern Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
In African boxing, Ghana will be sending at least 3 fighters to this year's Olympics in Tokyo, Japan. The latest to qualify is a light heavyweight who belongs to a boxing family. Kwabena Quicksilver Ofori reports from Accra, Ghana.
Ghana's amateur boxer Shaku Samir has qualified for the Tokyo Olympic Games. Shaku's qualification is based on the Boxing Task Force rankings released in February 2021, which placed him in 10th in the world and 3rd in Africa. Shaku's qualification has brought Ghana's boxing slot to 3 at the Tokyo Games, and will join already qualified boxers Samuel Techi, featherweight, and Suleiman Tete, flyweight. Shaku Samir, born into a boxing family, has 2 senior brothers, Bastia Samir and Issa Samir, now professional boxers and former members of Ghana Black Bombers, who were Olympians at the 2004 Athens Olympics and the 2008 Beijing Olympic Games. 22-year-old Shaku Samir, who fights in light heavyweight, appreciated all who supported him in the Olympic qualification.
I know I really deserve to be participating in this Tokyo Olympics Games. You know, all my brothers are Olympians and African medalists, and same as me. I'm following my brother's footsteps, and I'm promising all Ghanaians that they should be expecting a medal from me. I mean, I'm going straight to the medal zone. And thanks to all my supporters, Ghana Boxing Federation, I mean, Ghana Olympic, GOC, IOC, and all the Black Bombers. And I really thank them.
It will be recalled Shaku won the only medal for Ghana at the 2019 Rabat All African Games in Morocco and was awarded by Sports Writers Association of Ghana as Amateur Boxer of the Year 2019. For the Sunny Side of Sports, Kwabena Ofori in Accra.
Hello, listeners. This is Hussein Khalil from Uganda. I'm a gold medalist in Commonwealth Games 1982 in Brisbane, Australia. Listen to the Sine Side of Sports on Voice of America.
In more boxing news, you might say Mexican star Saul Canelo Alvarez has made a big impression at one of the most popular tourist attractions in Los Angeles, California. The world champion boxer placed his hands and feet in cement over the weekend outside the historic Grauman's Chinese Theater in Hollywood. It's a tradition that dates back to 1927. The honor, though, is usually reserved for Hollywood big-name actors like Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Kirk Douglas. After cementing his place, Canelo posed for photos. Last month, Canelo stopped Turkish fighter Avni Yildirim in the third round of their fight at Hard Rock Stadium in Florida. That win improved Canelo's record to 55 victories, one defeat, and one draw. Canelo is scheduled to fight again on May 8th near Dallas, Texas, where he'll take on Britain's Billy Joe Saunders in a world super middleweight unification fight. Canelo holds the WBA and WBC title belts, while Saunders is the WBO champion.
You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
World Athletics recently launched the first 3D virtual sports museum. It's an up-close, personal, and immersive experience for online visitors. The museum is hosted by the official World Athletics website, and you can check it out via this address, worldathletics.org/MOWA. That's M-O-W-A. Once again, the address, worldathletics.org/MOWA. M-O-W-A. The energetic Andy Edwards joins us now with a feature on the Museum of World Athletics. Sporty greetings, Andy.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. The Museum of World Athletics went online on March 15th, launched by the World Athletics president, Sebastian Coe, himself a double Olympic champion in the middle distances. This site will grow through the course of the year, expanding into what should be a treasure trove of historic memorabilia. It was fitting that the launch came 1 week after International Women's Day, since it included the presentation of a heritage plaque for the late Greta Weitz of Norway, the first ever world champion in the women's marathon and winner of 9 New York Marathon titles. There'll be more about her and the charismatic coach who guided Australia's Herb Elliott to greatness in the mile and 1500 metres in a moment. But first, here's Sebastian Coe on how MOWA, the Museum of World Athletics, online, will develop this year.
Looking ahead in July this year, the second stage of MOWA will be opened with our Olympic Athletics Collection Room. Then in the autumn, indoor athletics, cross-country, road running and race walking will be highlighted with the launch of our indoor and out-of-stadia collections room. It is the 3D technology which makes the Museum of World Athletics unique. MOWA is designed to look and feel like a real building. The visitor can roam around the museum freely and interact with over 60 exhibits and more than 400 items of supporting content, text, photos, and video. The museum platform, which is located on the World Athletics website, has content in both English and French.
When Greta Weitz was a junior international on the track and cross-country for Norway in the 1970s, women didn't have longer distances such as the 5 and 10,000 metres on the track, nor were there any championship titles at stake for them in the marathon. Weitz lacked the finishing speed to be a title threat on the track, but a marathon debut in New York in 1979 aroused her curiosity. Her husband, Jack, was a decent standard club runner himself and advised her in what turned out to be a career-changing victory, the first of 9 in New York City.
We never talked tactics. We had no idea about marathon. I told her the day of the marathon that she should just stay behind all the girls. It's going to be slow for you, but it's going to hurt. And of course, she didn't listen, and she took off, and she was really, really in pain the last 10-12K. And she broke the record, ran 2:32, and she was stormed by the US media. She wasn't used to win races in Europe, but this was different. But she was so angry at me that I had talked her into this. So she threw the shoes at me and said, that's it, never again.
In 1983, the first of what has become a sequence of so far 17 world championships in athletics was held in Helsinki. By then, Greta Weitz was the established number one. Elite women and mass runners were out on the roads and competing in unprecedented numbers. Now, Joan Benoit of the USA dashed her hopes of becoming the first women's Olympic champion in the marathon in Los Angeles the following year. But Weitz, who was sadly to die of cancer at the age of 57 in 2011, had made a lasting legacy for the sport. Sebastian Coe, who shared a platform with Jack Weitz during the online launch, reflected on Greta Weitz's achievement, seeing her as part of a long line following such Olympic stars as Fanny Blankers-Koen of the Netherlands and the USA's Babe Didriksen.
I put her contribution in our sport alongside athletes like Fanny Blankers-Koen, Babe Didriksen in 1932 in LA, Irina Shevinska, you know, Wyomir Tyus. I mean, these are absolute standout athletes, and for what she did to globalise distance running for women was absolutely inseparable from our history. So, Jack, it goes without saying, we're incredibly grateful for the donation. And we're equally pleased to have been able to just reflect on her career and mark it in our wonderful new museum.
A second heritage plaque was awarded to a coach, the figure who so often proves a catalyst in an athlete's career. Percy Cerruti from Australia was an uncompromising thinker who nurtured above all the development of Herb Elliott, who won the Olympic 1500 metres in Rome in 1960, breaking the world record as he left rivals trailing. Cerruti, who died at the age of 80 in 1975, was in many ways ahead of his time in terms of nutrition. Well, there was nothing easygoing about his self-made running camp on the sand dunes in Portsea near Melbourne. He developed an approach which was part Spartan in simplicity, part philosopher in its quest for greatness. And here is Herb Elliott on his mentor.
I would not be what I am or where I am if it hadn't been for him. The lucky accident of meeting Percy Cerruti when I was 17 or 18 years of age, still at school. And at that age where you want to smoke cigarettes, and I hated school. Once you get out of there, have a few grogs, go out with your mates, all that. You're at that age of 18 where you could go anywhere. And Percy came into my life and took me where I went. He was like a father. I lived in a small little apartment in Melbourne when I first met him. He lived in a house that was the size of a garage, and he had his bed and his cooking stuff and everything in there, and he had me. I used to turn up every night to eat with him because his wife was a really good cook. And there you are. We had a lot of time together, Percy and I, and he was a very, very tough, very ruthless, very positive man, but at the same time, he was highly inspiring, and he would just inspire us so much. He'd hear him talk. He would go and shake the trees and, you know, shake the world, and he was fantastic.
Sebastian Coe and Herb Elliott, during the museum launch, joked that their chat was turning into a mutual admiration society, but both have earned their laurels for their exploits on the track. If more recent fans of track and field are less familiar with the magnitude of Herb Elliott's achievements, Sebastian Coe, winner of the 1500 gold at the Moscow Olympics of 1980, and again in Los Angeles 4 years later, put them in context.
You are the person I've always looked to in my sport. I still think your 1500 metre run in Rome was the definitive run. To break a world record and to win an Olympic title in such a definitive way was really the template that I just drew heavily on for the rest of my career.
World Athletics set up its heritage department in 2018, and MOWA is a big step forward in public access online. By the end of this year, many more items will be available online for viewing, and the history of the number one Olympic sport will be set out in ever greater detail. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Andy Edwards in London.
Thanks, Andy. I enjoyed your feature, and I'm sure athletics will once again be in the spotlight at this year's Tokyo Olympics. One Kenyan star who certainly will get some attention in Japan is Eliud Kipchoge, the world record holder and defending Olympic champion in the men's marathon. Eliud is looking forward to testing himself in the Hamburg Marathon in Germany on April 11th in the build-up to his Olympic title defense. Kipchoge has been described as the leading light in the NN running team, and the team shared this Eliud quote as he prepares for the Hamburg Marathon. "Hamburg has a lot of memories for me," says Kipchoge. "It was my first exposure to the marathon. It was the beginning of my life in the marathon." And Kipchoge continues, "Winning there gave me confidence that I could run the marathon, and it played a big role in my career. Now I'm running Hamburg again in a very different situation. We have very few races globally, and it's a good opportunity to test myself, run well, and offer hope to the world."
Hello, sports fans. This is Paul Tergat, marathon champion from Kenya. You are listening to the Sony Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Take your pick, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
And to quote Shaka, "From the deepest better part of the bottom of my heart, I want to give a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Shaka Sali for a memorable career at the Voice of America. Shaka is planning to retire at the end of May. The Sunny Side of Sports remembers Hall of Fame basketball player Elgin Baylor, who died Monday at the age of 86. The AP's Dave Ferry tells us more.
Elgin Baylor was among the very best NBA players of his era, averaging 27.4 points and 13.5 rebounds during a 14-year career spent entirely with the Lakers. The Lakers have announced that Baylor died Monday of natural causes at age 86. Baylor was outstanding in the Lakers' first three seasons after leaving Minneapolis, averaging 35.3 points, 17.3 rebounds, and 4.9 assists from 1960 to 63.
Points, you know, the only many thing is if whether or not you win the game and how you play the total game. I think when you look at stats a lot of times, they can be misleading. Certainly you get a lot of points. Maybe the other parts of the game, you're not really making the contribution you should.
The 11-time All-Star never won a scoring title and went 0-7 in NBA Finals Series, eclipsed in points by Wilt Chamberlain and beaten six times by the Boston Celtics.
They did a good job. Sat Sanders checked, defended against me most of the time. He was a great defender, and certainly he made it tough for you. You had to really work hard to score, and with Russell there, you always have to look out for Bill Russell. So it was tough anytime you played against the Celtics, but it was fun because you know you had to work. You're in for a good game. They would bring out the best or worst in you.
I'm Dave Ferry.
Thanks, Dave. Elgin Baylor has also been described as an athletic pioneer in the NBA with his high-flying moves to the basket. He would be followed by other soaring players like Julius, Dr. J. Irving, and Michael Jordan. Amnesty International is shining a spotlight on the deaths of migrant workers in Qatar as the country prepares to host the 2022 FIFA World Cup football tournament. Joining us with more details is VOA's Gwen Uden. Hey there, Gwen.
Hey there, Sonny. Qatar is set to host the FIFA World Cup for the first time in 2022, and the small Gulf Arab country has taken on the huge task of building infrastructure, including 7 high-tech stadiums, to support the upcoming tournament. But a recent report by The Guardian reveals that in the decades since Qatar was awarded hosting rights, more than 6,500 migrant workers from South Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa have died. And many of those deaths are directly linked to the construction sites of World Cup stadiums. Last week, Amnesty International published a report that called on FIFA President Gianni Infantino to do more to protect migrant workers who are exposed to forced labor, unpaid wages, and excessive working hours in Qatar. And Amnesty spokesman Stephen Cockburn tells Reuters News he's urging FIFA to do its part to prevent human rights violations connected to the tournament.
We sent a letter to Infantino. We've not had a response yet, and we've engaged with FIFA very often over the years. We know that they're committed to ensure that the World Cup does leave a positive legacy. We want them to do much more. We want them to make sure that they're much more hands-on in the delivery of the tournament, to make sure the workers' rights on stadiums and other projects in the country are respected. We want them to have a much stronger voice towards the Qatari government, to make sure that they're speaking out, to make sure that Qatar fulfills its commitments towards its workers. And we want to make sure that human rights are embedded in future tournaments as well, to make sure we don't see the repeat of what we've seen and the different controversies and scandals over the last decade.
Last week, Gianni Infantino held a news conference to address the growing criticism over worker rights in Qatar and told reporters that human rights protections are a top priority for FIFA. And he said while progress has been made, there's always room for improvement.
When it comes to the situation in Qatar in particular, I think we need to be fair there as well and admit that a lot of progress has happened. A lot of progress in the conditions of the workers. Of course, more can be done everywhere, always, even in Switzerland, probably. But we need to also look a little bit, and we're always good at giving lessons to everyone, we need to look a little bit also at the history, at where people, countries, regions are coming from. It took us in Europe how many decades, probably centuries, to arrive where we are today. Other countries are doing the same process in a few years. We need to recognize that. We need to recognize as well that without the spotlight, of course, of the World Cup, no progress would happen. Now, some progress has happened. This has been recognized not by FIFA, but by international organizations, workers' organizations, in particular the abolishment of the kafala system, the minimum wages, just to mention two, the healthcare matters. More can be done, always. Of course, more can be done.
Amnesty's Stephen Cockburn acknowledged that FIFA is taking its human rights policy more seriously, but expressed concern that recent improvements could be reversed.
The question, I think, is more, are they prepared to go the extra mile to make sure it happens, to make sure they're more hands-on in the delivery of the tournament in terms of protecting workers' rights? Are they prepared to speak out to make sure that Qatar delivers on its reforms? Will they speak out if Qatar tries to reverse some reforms? Is a big question. And will they make sure that future tournaments are better organized and that the bidding process really embeds human rights to make sure that we don't see this again?
Cockburn adds that conversations with national football associations about the World Cup have been positive, and he is encouraging them to speak out more and use their power and influence to ensure workers are well treated. Meanwhile, in a statement issued to Reuters, the Qatar government said it is setting new standards to improve the lives of millions of people and remains committed to working closely with its international partners, including Amnesty International, International to protect all workers and ensure new labor reform laws are effectively implemented and enforced. And that is all from me, Sonny. Back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten. And that wraps up the March 23rd edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. And that's the sunny side of sports.